Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's Wednesday morning, 12 minutes after 9 o'clock. Ray Graff here. We're on the Roundtable panel, at least until President Trump begins to speak. He is scheduled at, was scheduled at 9 to address the nation with some remarks following last night's missile attack in Iraq. We will keep talking until then, and then we'll let him talk, and then we'll come back and talk some more. Who's doing the talking? Well, we have WAMC's Alan Shartok here. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill on the panel today. SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson is here, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, all here. Rosemary Armeo expected, much like the president. You can email us. Oh, well, okay, the president's not here, but Rosemary's here. The email address is panel at WAMC.org. There, her roadie is bringing in a chair. Panel at WAMC.org. Come on in, sit down. We'll close the door like a real radio station. Keep your emails brief, if you could, to the point. No abbreviations, no attachments. Well, Rosemary, since you were not in the room.
I heard every word.
All right. President Trump is going to speak at some point.
Yes, I know.
Okay. And we'll just turn that microphone on. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everybody doing?
Morning.
Good.
Good.
Great.
Happy New Year.
And also with you. Well, we all watched the news probably too late last night. Iran struck back at the U.S. for killing a top Revolutionary Guard commander, calling it revenge for the killing of Qassem Soleimani. U.S. officials say Iran fired a series of ballistic missiles at two military bases in Iraq housing American troops. No immediate reports of casualties. What we're hearing, Bob, so far is that no casualties at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting listening to some of the pundits talk about whether this was intended or not. And there's a lot of thinking going on right now that this was really meant more as a warning rather than an escalation. So it was trying to balance the need to appear strong and respond to the attack last week, but at the same time not escalate this into a hot war. You know, Ray, I think a couple of issues that the listeners, I think, should be thinking about is one of the things the Iranians did, though, is that they used some of the more advanced ballistic missiles. And rather than short-term or mid-term weaponry, they used relatively sophisticated ballistic missiles. And that's a real clear message to our military and to our allies in both Saudi Arabia and in Israel that there is weaponry that Iran has that can be used throughout that region. So, you know, I would not view this as a failed attack on the part of the Iranians. I think it was a much more measured attack, but it was sending multiple layers of messages.
The messages it sends, Rosemary, to the public there, initially they can the Iranian government can say, okay, well, this was a smashing success. Word eventually should filter back to the populace that, okay, nobody was hurt. They, if it was intended, then it probably a show of weakness. If it was not intended, it's a show of some very bad military technology. How can this be a win for the Iranian government?
I think the Iranian government is acting the way the U.S. government should be acting, and so far we haven't seen it. It's in Trump's court now. I think they made a vow to retaliate, and they did. It's similar to the attack, I think, that Trump made against Syria. After, remember, the last chemical attack, he attacked the place where the chemical bombs had been launched but didn't kill anybody, did property damage. That's exactly what they did. I like the idea of sending the message about the weaponry. And, of course, it came with a note from the Iranian government saying, okay, the ball's now in your court. If you retaliate against this, give us this one because you owed it to us. But if you retaliate again, Dubai gets it and Haifa. And there it is. It's two other countries not involved in this. They instantly will escalate.
Alan.
Well, I think both leaders had a little bit of a problem. The president realized, as did the people who surround him, that we could wake up this morning and we could be in a war if this was misplayed. So he backed down. I think there's no question about that right now. And frankly, thank God he did. I don't know who prevailed. I don't know how they did it, but they all ran up to the White House, and obviously there was a conference, and I think they told them to cut it out, that this is not playing with a presidential candidate or something. So And for the Ayatollah, he couldn't win that war, and he knew it. And with this president, who is completely unpredictable, and it could have been sending nukes around, the Ayatollah said, okay, we'll take a Pyrrhic victory here. That's the way I'm reading it.
What's the Pyrrhic victory?
Well, in other words, we sent the missiles, but we didn't. But we, first of all, two things that have now become plain. One, they told the Iraqis that it was coming and where it was coming. So everybody was sent down into the.
They were all hunkered down.
The president,
which is also what happened in that Syria.
Exactly, yeah. The same as Syria. Yeah.
And the president, for his part, announced that this is where it was coming.
The Iranians have opened up a period of reflection and possible return to diplomacy. Now will America take it?
And what's really not clear is where these missiles actually landed. I'm confused about this because we have so little information. We're hearing there's no casualties. I hope that's the truth. But if these missiles are as sophisticated as we hear that they are, did they just intentionally make them all miss? I mean, the lack of information that we've had about everything that has happened from the time Soleimani was killed all the way up and through last night, to me, is really disturbing. Mm-hmm. The fact that we're making these assumptions based on very vague information coming from really less than credible sources, I think is very disturbing. And I think that this administration needs to come forward and tell us exactly what's going on. And I think they're learning through the impeachment process that they can actually get away with not telling us the facts.
And let's remember that the United States Constitution makes it very clear that the power to declare war is with the Congress. And so we know that this president doesn't like to do that.
Yeah, but Congress has completely abdicated that power for generations now. I mean, and that is something that needs to change. And that, you know,
I couldn't agree with you more. Got to take it back.
The only point, though, Terry, is that they didn't miss. I mean, the targets they were seeking to influence was both their at home, making sure that their supporters in Iran knew that they were strong and going to react militarily.
Try to save face a little bit.
But they were also speaking to a broader audience. They're speaking to Germany and Britain and France and saying things like, look, we're the same group in this dispute, and why are you continuing to support the U.S. and things like all of the diplomacy that we've been have a strong coalition. How do we break the coalition? I'm sure they were speaking also to Russia and Putin, who I fully expect to offer to step in as a mediator in this and show himself as a world peacemaker. They may not have killed anybody on the base, but they certainly have done substantial damage to our international relationships and our power and prestige in that region.
Did you see, Bob, that Putin landed in Damascus yesterday?
I did not. That does not surprise me.
Yes. Backing your theory. He's either peacemaker would be one role, which he has played in the Middle East before, but he's moving into Iraq, too. That's plain.
Well, he's filling a vacuum.
Filling the vacuum.
Yeah, he's filling a vacuum. There's a lack of leadership. There's chaos. So he steps in.
Yep. Rosemary, I think your point about Iraq is very well taken. Because there's another not-so-subtle war going on as to Iraq basically saying to the Americans, get out.
Yep. Suleiman's whole effort was directed to that. Mm-hmm. So by assassinating him, and that's another thing, there's a whole war going on about whether to call it an assassination, which I belittled a listener for bringing up yesterday, and they were right. By assassinating him, we have done his job far better and in far quicker time than he could ever have accomplished.
And his bad public policy, and this is one of the things that I get upset about, is that Trump goes after both Bush and Obama, saying, well, you should have done this. No, we purposely didn't do it because that's not the way our foreign policy has been in place. And for folks at home, it says, oh, this is a sign of American strength. I actually think it's a sign of American weakness and disarray in our foreign policy. And it's a great example of sending really mixed messages to both our allies and enemies about are you going to attack or not? I mean, what is true and what isn't? And can we really depend on the United States to be a partner?
So in the next few minutes before the president comes on.
I'm told now it may be 11 a.m. before the president speaks. So yeah, I'll keep you posted on that.
Because they have no idea what to say.
Well,
because
it's like 9 a.m. D.C.
He's still having his lucky charms.
I just wanted to finish that thought, which is, and you guys are right on target there, is what's he going to say?
I think it's more like he has one thing he wants to say, and those advisors and counselors are trying to tamper it.
Well, here's the problem is that we are in a situation where we have never, as best as I can tell, had any type of goal, any type of real strategy in place as it comes to dealing with Iraq or Iran. What is it that this president ever wanted out of Iran in the first place? When he pulled out of the nuclear deal, what did he want?
I know what he wanted. He wanted to have an enemy. This guy always needs an enemy, and Iran was a perfect example of that. Not the Saudi Arabians, who are really corrupt and really have some terrible aspects to them. He wanted Iran, and when you say, what did he want? He wanted them to be his enemy.
In addition to having no public press conferences, it's now over 360 days, not telling us what's going on in Ukraine or in the Middle East. He also told the Russians about this attack on Soleimani before it happened. Didn't tell Congress, of course. Told the Russians, and now it's come out. He was in conference with the defense minister, the assistant defense minister of Saudi Arabia. They sat down and talked. We found out about that from Saudi Arabia press.
The Russian,
there's hardly any reporters there.
The Russian part to me is really fascinating. Yeah. It's fascinating to me that they didn't then turn around and warn Soleimani, right? Like, I mean, they allowed it to just go through. Iran is supposed to be an ally.
But Chris, why would if you were a Russian official, why would you? If you look at this and say, wow, this is going to completely destabilize this region and it's going to further weaken the United States and we don't have to do anything,
why would you warn them? Yeah.
Well, I mean, Iran is supposed to be one of their allies, right? I mean,
they were too busy
laughing. Iran is still their ally. They didn't lose Iran as an ally from this.
Yeah, you know, and even the you know going back and it's slightly older news, but it's certainly related to this is the whole issue of the drone strike on Suleiman. And my problem is the definition of imminent threat. And what I'm struggling with, and I certainly probably, with the exception of Ray, probably the most hawkish person at this table right now, struggle. Well, it's all right, Ray.
I'm not that hawkish, right?
Well. Yes, you're right. I'm probably the most hawkish person at this table.
Don't give in.
I look at it and I say, I was thinking, if a police officer shot somebody because there was an imminent threat of something they may do next week or in the weeks down the road, we wouldn't say that was a proper use of lethal force. And I'm still struggling with this notion that Pompeo put out that this was an imminent threat. And to me, an imminent threat is they're ready to launch an attack now, and this was meant to disrupt that. And that's what I'm looking to hear to see
the evidence. The confidential report went to Congress yesterday, and it was leaked, of course, probably by Democrats. And it refers to nothing except what happened in the past, nothing imminent, all in the past.
Could I just go back to the Ayatollah for a second? I'm sorry, Chris. And that is the Ayatollah. He could be crying over the coffin here of Soleimani, but he has achieved a great deal here. He had a country which was getting split down the middle.
Bingo.
Right? No Spot question. On. The guy becomes a sacrificial pawn, and there's none of that dissension right now in Iran.
And that's why our foreign policy has always been never to create martyrs.
Mm-hmm. Because we do it all the time, though. I mean, that's what I was just going to say before. We've killed 3,800 people by drone strike in recent years. How many of those people were imminent threats? I mean, is this as big a break from our tradition as we like to think that it is? You know, I mean, we're killing people there all the time. And it never even goes reported.
Well, you do make a point. The Obama administration liked their drones quite a bit. That was a pretty easy thing to do.
I think that the difference in my mind, though, is that you're talking about a recognized official from another country, and the majority of the drone strikes were dealing with more terrorist groups. And I'm not trying to get into the argument of the efficacy of our drone policy because I think it's significantly in question. But this is a really different different animal in my mind. If let me give you, for instance, okay, if the head of our Joint Chiefs of Staff flew into pick a country,
Venezuela,
and is at the airport and is then blown up, would we just sit back?
No, sir.
There's no way. I mean, it would absolutely force a retaliation. And Alan, where I think you are correct, and I'm really interested to see what comes out at 11 o'clock, I don't think all is well. And the question is, are we going to be able to de-escalate this right now, or is there going to be another tit for tat? And that's where you start to see the spiral. I'm also worried about the proxies and the idea of the proxies now getting involved in that blending so much that we're not able to differentiate between the proxy attack or an Iranian attack. And that's going to create the risk of a much, much broader war.
Well, they're not going to stop doing what they've been doing, that's for sure. You make a good point.
But if the proxies are in fact being directed by Iran, then what's the difference?
The difference is that Soleimani had them under control. They were disciplined. They were all marching towards one goal that he was able to articulate, and he's gone now. So there is some worry that Iran is given this break now. It looks like the bigger person and the bigger person, you know what I mean, than the United States. Like, let's calm down here. But those guys are all let loose. Hezbollah is nuts. They're itching to go after Israel. The entire Middle East and Jordan right now, the embassy is saying, stay really careful, keep a low profile. It's still a tinderbox.
We should talk about that tweet that you just mentioned that he sent out last night, where he did say all is well.
What a jerk.
No, I mean, it sounds to me like the kind of statement you would get from a country like North Korea, where you have authoritarian rule, where you have dictators just saying things as propaganda the truth go away.
So why did he say it? He said it because the top guys in the country, the defense people, came and said, Mr. President, you are 2 inches away from a war. And the last thing that this country really needs is a major confrontation, and it will cost you your election, your re-election. So the president says, so what should I do? Say all is well. It means we're standing down. That's what it meant.
Well, when he decided to go after Soleimani, he basically did the equivalent of taking a baseball bat to a hornet's nest. That's what he did.
Yes.
I'm just going to go hit this thing and see what happens. I have no idea. I have no strategy in place. I don't really know what to do after they come after me, but I'm just going to do it. And now he just says all is well because he knows that he is now in a corner. I do agree with Bob that I think we are in a much weaker place than we were even a week ago, even a few days ago. And that we've really created a martyr. We've helped a terrorist country promote itself. We've given them the upper hand. What exactly is his next move? What is it we're trying to do?
I'll draw back to an earlier conversation that we had on the roundtable about the Kurds. And this is where all of these pieces become connected. You know, you talk about proxies. Our proxies used to be the Kurds, and then we completely sold them out.
Correct.
So you start to think about all of these missteps in this region, which, again, I'll go back to one of my favorite comments, that nothing appears like a conspiracy quite like incompetence. I think what we're doing is that we are completely incompetent in our foreign policy under this administration, and this staggering around in the dark is reflected.
But the only thing that matters, I know you got to go, but the only thing that matters here to Trump is his reelection. And the question we should be considering, among everything else, is did the American people subscribe to what Trump just did?
We have to take a break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We will get to some of your letters very shortly. We'll break for some news. We'll be back. That's Nerea from the album Bloom. This is the Roundtable. 9:34 is the time. It's a Wednesday morning. Again, we had heard that President Trump was going to address the press and the nation somewhere around 9 a.m. I believe now the administration, according to what I am told, is going to address Congress first and then the nation around 11. But we'll keep you posted. Things seem to be a little fluid at the moment. The roundtable panel is in session. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Bob Griffin is here, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. And we have letters.
We have letters, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot more here at WAMC.org?
Yeah, it's panel at WAMC.org.
Yes, that's right, panel at WAMC.org.
Email
right,
address.
You are.
Right.
David says, Iran. It looks like Trump keeps getting away with his outrageous behavior as Iran let him off easy, giving Iraq and the U.S. advance warnings of their missile attack. Iran is looking more civilized and respectful of Iraq. Unfortunately, whatever the consequences of Trump's behavior, all American and foreign nations will pay the price and suffer the most with chaos, deaths, expense, and potential annihilation. Trump must be brought to justice.
Bob, the one analyst was saying that the Iranian missiles are all mobile. They're not from a fixed base, so that it's really pretty easy by satellite to tell when they're getting into position and moving around. Is that right?
I would say just the opposite. Because they are so mobile, it's really difficult to identify where they are. In the fact that you can mask them, so from a satellite they look the same as a delivery lorry.
But some of the reporting this morning says that the Trump administration was aware that they were moving yesterday.
Well, right. we were definitely aware, but
the ability to fueling up allegedly.
Right, the ability to target them beforehand, though, I think is a lot harder. If you think back to the Iraqi war with the Scud missiles that were fired into Israel, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. So it is difficult.
The technology of this war is really fascinating, and it's part of how dangerous it all is. And we talked about the drones, which, again, started in the Obama administration. It isn't just you talked about the efficacy of the drone policy. I would talk about the ethics of it. If you're putting troops on the line to take out a top-level official, you're going to think a lot more about it than Trump did in the Situation Room.
Yeah, and it becomes a question for collectively whether we want our foreign policy to support political assassinations.
Correct.
So we also heard from Marilyn, who said, state of affairs. The fact that the Iranian government is acting more measured than the U.S. and we are relying on their, Iran's, restraint is absurd and alarming. Stop analyzing this as if we have a normal administration. It is not serving anyone. The only statement I want from this president is his resignation. Again, we will not get the truth or cannot trust anything this administration says. We had an Iran deal, not perfect, but a deal. The current occupant of the Oval and the complicit GOP is responsible for the fallout. Please stop talking about this like we have sane people leading our country.
Well, you know, the writer makes a point. We're all waiting to hear what the president has to say, but yet we know that it could just be one big flat lie. I mean, there's just no reason to believe anything that comes from this administration. They have zero credibility at this point.
I wouldn't believe anything any administration says when it comes to war. I mean, we had that Washington Post report a few weeks ago that said the Bush and Obama administrations lied and lied and lied and lied about what was going on in the Middle East. So.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, there is that. I mean, the whole reason we're in Iraq in the first place is one just giant big lie. I mean, that's a good point.
Well, Marilyn says it is not serving anyone. I think with one major exception, he sees it as serving himself and his reelection.
Yeah, I agree. I think it allows him to beat his chest and talk to the MAGA crowd about how he's brought the America back from weakness and if you hear that jingoistic nationalism. Yeah. I mean, even after the strike, putting the American flag up, I thought that was completely inappropriate. I really did.
It was. You know, we're blaming Trump, rightly so, but let us not forget Lindsey, who told Iran to cut out the crap or we'll get you. Come on. That's like a little schoolyard bully. And Hannity was especially odious yesterday, saying, Iran, we're going to go after you and get your oil. Come on.
Although I did think that Tucker Carlson Hannity fight was, I mean, I could sit and eat popcorn and watch that thing for a while.
Okay, so Barbara writes.
Come closer.
Oh, I'm so sorry,
come
Ray.
Closer.
You're right. You're the radio guy here. Barbara says, prediction. Who on the panel would like to bet that Trump delays his news conference till 1:30? Why? In order to upstage Governor Cuomo's State of the State.
I would actually enjoy that.
Oh,
I was thinking the one person that's definitely not going to be happy about this is
we have, with all due respect to the governor, we're talking about a gnat compared to what's going on in this country.
I give him credit. There's precious few other top-level politicians willing to say to his face, Trump, you're a jerk. And Cuomo has done that. Give him credit.
We're stereo. So theoretically, the engineer could have the State of the State in the left channel and Trump at 1:30 in the right channel. But Trump's scheduled for 11, though.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you really think that if Trump decided to come on at 1:30 and to accept this, that we wouldn't be playing Trump as opposed to the governor?
Oh, we'd have to. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I think it is more important clear, than the governor's priority. State of state. Not yeah. that we aren't looking forward to hearing from the governor.
Getting back to your point, Bob, about jingoism and MAGA, didn't Trump really run on – wasn't he sort of like he broke the mold and said, well, I'm getting everybody out. And now, isn't this going against the type that he ran on?
It totally is, which speaks to that Tucker Carlson versus Hannity spat that you were talking about. Right. I mean, Tucker has been kind of the voice of the Trumpian right, which is very non-interventionalist.
I think you hit it right on the head. But I think, again, if you're confused about this, Ray, all of our allies and even our enemies across the globe are confused about it as well, because we don't have there isn't a clear position either morally or politically about what the United States stands for internationally.
Okay, well, let me address that point before we get to the next letter. Back in the day of Reagan and the Cold War, and I can only go by the reports that were released by the KGB after the fall, but they were petrified because they had no idea what the hell Reagan was going to do. So is there not a certain amount of tactical, if not strategic, advantage to being unpredictable?
You know, it's I would say that there may be a small tactical advantage, but unpredictability leads to too much confusion. And it's really hard to get support from your allies and coalition when you've got the confusion. Now, let's go back to Reagan for a second, okay? Mm-hmm. He was about coalition building. And even in the height of the Cold War, remember what his comment was, trust but verify.
Or take down that wall.
Take down the wall, right? But at no point in time did he insult our UK allies, the French, German, our Japanese allies. It this is so very different than Reagan.
Okay, he did joke on the air about nuking Russia, a very planned off the cuff remark. And the files show that they said they didn't know what this crazy cowboy was going to do.
Yes, right, and I'm sure that's true. But looking back, we know better. And comparing Reagan to the present occupant, to Trump, I think we now know that Reagan was a source of moderation compared to this guy, who really is off the wall in terms of making a prediction, because we don't know what he's thinking at any given moment.
Well, there is the dementia element in both common to both presidents.
Well, but the one thing that makes this president stand out from all the other administrations is that all the other administrations, regardless of what you think about them, had a very strong diplomacy operation. They worked very hard mm-hmm. to build those coalitions. They had diplomats talking to diplomats in all countries. So mm-hmm. while they may have said something that left people off guard and not knowing what was going to come next, they knew they had support within coalitions. And this president doesn't even know what the word diplomacy means. We seem to have zero capability to do it at this moment.
So when Reagan said, take down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, he had good information as to what was going on in East Germany, which was that there was a collapse. It was right there, right then. Anyway, shall I read more?
Oh, sure.
Are you sure?
Kidding me? Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Okay. So we heard from Barbara, who thought that it would be delayed till 1:30 so as to interfere with it. Okay, Rod says, assassination of Soleimani. Just a matter of time until drone strikes on our military generals and other American targets by other countries become possible. When that time comes, our present actions will have provided them with their justification.
I agree with that. I think the world generally will take we'll watch what the United States does as a bellwether of what's acceptable and what's not. And I think that this changes what the rules of engagement are going to be, which gets back to the problem of the Weak War Powers Act from Congress and what their role is in this. So I do think it creates an environment that is more difficult to say this is morally repugnant and should be internationally illegal when we're the ones doing it.
Doesn't so much of it just come down to raw power? We're getting letters that the Iranians are model citizens because they've you know, taken a little bit of a leave in this thing. You know, I think that the Iranians know that the United States has the potential to do huge damage to them. And it's not that they're good citizens. It's that they're just thinking.
I think it's just strategy. And I'm not sure it's the citizens. I think it's the government doing it. I mean, yeah. I think the Ayatollah was over that Soleimani's coffin crying. And I think they were tears of gratitude. They had,
exactly.
And his sacrifice has put Iran in a great position.
Exactly.
We have to take a quick break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Bob Griffin is here from the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany. Terry Gibson is here, former New York State Senator, now a professor. Chris Churchill, a columnist. What? I didn't say. No, we have another professor here. Alan Shartok is here. He's also an ex-professor. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 9:46 is the time. It's Wednesday morning. Bob Griffin is here. Terry Gibson, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Alan Shartok. It's the Roundtable panel, and the email address is panel@wamc.org. Before we get to letters, Bob wanted to share another thought on the Reagan thing.
You know, Ray, you made a really interesting point before we went to break about Reagan versus Trump.
I wasn't really making a comparison. I was just saying the element of unpredictability had the Russians somewhat shaking their heads.
I thought it was a great point. Just take it as thank you is all you need to say as a compliment.
All right, fine.
But here's the major difference, okay? Under Reagan, we were wondering what the Russians were thinking. Under Trump, we're not because he's telling them.
That's a good point.
If you want to juxtapose those two and say how wacky the world has become, I think that as much as anything shows you the difference. When would we have ever given Russia a preemptive idea of what was going on in the Mideast?
Or last night, Iraq was informed by Iran, who then Iraq, according to sources that we're seeing on CNN, then informed us before the attack.
But think about that. From Iran's point, brilliant. Because what it did is that, unlike the United States, we respect your sovereignty. And this is why the United States and the foreign invaders, the Crusaders, should not be allowed to stay in your territory. Again.
But they knew that Iraq would tell us, be compelled to tell us.
They absolutely did, but they weren't speaking. They weren't worried about the attack because they knew the attack was more symbolic than military. They were doing is that they were speaking to the Iranian parliament saying, yes, throw them out.
Unlike the United States, Iran has a long-term policy. They know exactly what they're doing. And they're in a weaker position, but look how they've played that over the last few months.
I want to go to Bob and ask him a question. He's the dean of the School of Emergency Preparedness. Now, we all went to bed last night wondering about how prepared we were and what would happen if the nukes began to fly or if there as the head of your unit, your academic unit, were you thinking, my God, this is my job?
Is it my job to worry?
Your job to figure out what emergency preparedness we have.
It is. Although, I'll be honest, I never have felt that we are anywhere near close to sort of a nuclear. Where I see it is that the potential for this war, for a shooting war, is greater than it's ever been with Iran potentially.
Okay, let's assume that's the
case.
Sure.
What I'm thinking about the issues of, you know, what happens if you institute a draft? What happens to my students? What happens to my boys?
Sure.
I mean, what happens? Because we're talking about we're not talking about the type of war that we've been used to, where it's very sanitized and it's somewhere else. We're talking about a military that is going to put up a stiff fight. Do I think we would win eventually? Yes, I do. But I think the cost would be incredibly great. And I think you got to start to think about sort of those secondary and tertiary situations. So I absolutely do think that. The other piece that I think a lot about is, from the Homeland Security standpoint in Intel, how do we continue to strengthen our own infrastructures, you know, both physical and cultural, in order to preserve and protect, but at the same time make it so that this country doesn't become an armed camp. And I think this has always been the problem, that we don't balance as well as we probably should, that we overreact. You'll look at something like the Patriot Act, and you say, okay, I understand why it was put in place, but when in hindsight, you look back and say, we gave up too many of our civil liberties in order for that to happen. So that this is all part of the conversation that has to happen as far as the college. I think it's not just about being prepared. It's all of the other issues of the ethics and the civil liberties issues and the legal issues that we've got to start to make sure that our students are learning, so as they become leaders in this field, that they're thinking multidimensionally on these problems.
Bob, one of the secondary effects that I've been worried about since this latest crisis began was Israel. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is poised. They're looking for an excuse to happen all along to fire rockets into Israel at a time when Netanyahu is in worse trouble with this Congress and the legal system than our president. And that seems to be a real – if that were to happen, there'd be direct American interests, be a hot war. It would be in a part of the world where our political – interests are directly entangled. What do you have any predictions or thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do, and they're a little grim, actually. Given Netanyahu and Netanyahu's legal issues and his desire to be pardoned for any and all crimes, I worry about a situation like this is that you'll see a marked escalation because it's as much about his future as it is about the future of Israel.
Certainly true of Trump.
Yeah,
it's the same thing, and their allies in that seems.
And I'll go back to a couple of points. There was a reason that we kept our embassy in Tel Aviv, not in Jerusalem, is that there was enough concerns about destabilizing the region that's why we didn't move our embassy. There's a reason that we didn't support building in the occupied West Bank and in other areas.
Yep.
We have completely changed our foreign policy in the course of 3 years, and we would be silly to not expect a backlash from the people who have lost something.
Will you say something, Chris?
No, I wasn't.
I have another question because I'll jump in if nobody has anything to say. And that is, if you're talking about changes in infrastructure, embassies seem to be one of those to me. That Baghdad embassy is like a big target in the Middle East. Why does America – we don't have diplomacy anymore under Trump. Why do we have embassies, which are just absolutely places to attack and hurt us? And they're hugely expensive to defend.
So we should abolish all the embassies?
I think there's a better way to do business, a modern way to do business. You needed embassies in the days when you had to be there. You had to have a presence when there was no internet, when there were no office buildings set up in these countries where you could just put bureaucrats and scatter them so they wouldn't be all in one place ready to bomb.
And what do you do when your passport is stolen?
You can go to a consulate office, but you don't need a giant fortress, which is what Baghdad or Sarajevo or Algiers is.
But I disagree with you. I think the embassy is a critically important symbol of our presence in the fact that even though we may not be talking right now, there is a willingness to talk. It's also, if you look at the amount of business that embassies do, if you've been abroad, you have seen it.
I have been abroad, I think they're so off-putting. I hate them.
I would absolutely oppose the idea of eliminating embassies. And anyway, it becomes a semantical game. If you're going to do it a consulate, you're going to have to protect that too, so the consulate then becomes a fortress.
Sure.
You
put all your CIA agents into an embassy, and it becomes a military target. And we've seen that in Africa, in the Middle East. There's a different way to do it.
I will note, though, that part of the germs of the seeds of the current situation was that the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian revolution, it violated international law with our embassy with what they did.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a longstanding practice.
Right.
They changed that.
Right.
Okay. That wasn't the United States. That was Iran did that.
Right.
And going back to our letters, Tom writes, "Dear panel, Trump's long game is shaping up nicely for him. In the wake of the ongoing Iran conflict, Trump will announce via his imaginary executive powers, with the support of the Senate, the Justice Department, the Supreme Court, the cessation of the 2020 electoral process. The world is too much dangerous turmoil right now to chance a presidential election." That he has quotes around that. "Thus, Supreme Commander Trump will never face a trial, and his continued range will be assured." And that's Tom from Wappingers Falls.
Well, 100%. That's what's going to happen.
Chris.
And we've also heard from Brian, who says, military father ranting. Military father ranting. As a father of a Navy nuclear tech serving on a ballistics nuclear sub, he's told me these missiles are so precise that they can hit a dime on the side of a barn. It's possible that the strike with no casualties could be a warning that the next time it could be worse. Hopefully he doesn't ignore his military advisors and follow their advice rather than go on his own tirade. And when he said he doesn't ignore it, he's talking about Trump, not his son.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the question. And my sense is that the type of ballistic missiles that they use, and this morning I heard references to both the MK and the Fatah, which is some of their most advanced. I don't know if they're as precise as some of the things that we have, or the Russians have, or the Chinese have, but they're precise enough.
They went about 800 miles, right?
Yeah.
If where they say they were launched from is accurate, it was about 800 miles.
That's correct, which is an impressive feat of engineering. Although I will also note, this shows the inherent weakness in our cyber programs, because Iran and China and others have stolen generations worth of technology and engineering from both the government and our private businesses, and have been allowed to leapfrog in advancements that they didn't need to pay for. So again, this is all wrapped into that whole issue of an overall weakness in cybersecurity of critical infrastructure and what it means to this country.
Now, I have a huge number of letters, or as some people say letters, some people say emails here in front of me.
Yeah.
How would you like me to proceed?
Well, I tell you what, Daddy-O, why don't you do one more, and then we'll take a break for news, and then we'll come back and you do whatever you want.
Okay. June says, Ukrainian plane crash. Did anyone else, I would hope so, hear about the plane crash that took off from Iran and going to Ukraine? It was also a 737, was about the same time as the missile strikes. Just getting too weird.
Well, and we were going to talk about that in the next hour. So 176 are dead, and Iran, according to what I'm seeing on the cable news with no sound, will not give up the black box. So,
but there were no Americans on board. They were mostly Iranians and a lot of Canadians. And there is no evidence that directly ties them
together. It is a weird coincidence, though.
It is.
Yeah. British, Swedish, Afghan, German nationals also killed. And we will get to that coming up. It's the roundtable panel. We have Terry Gibson here, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok, and Bob Griffin. You can join us, although the stack of emails is getting big, big, big. But give it a shot. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 10:06 is the time. It's the Roundtable panel with Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, and Robert Griffin. And the stack of correspondence is huge, Alan Shartok.
It continues to grow. So let's take a stab at it. Mike says, heard today on Morning Joe, a congressman with military experience cautioning against designating military personnel like this Iranian we killed as a terrorist. He cautions that by doing so, we risk having our military leaders and personnel as terrorists as well. Apparently, by doing so, the protection that are usually afforded the military are not afforded designated terrorists. He thinks this is dangerous. Mike from Glens Falls. Belinda says,
good point.
This has nothing to do with any new imminent threats and everything to do with moving impeachment off the front page. He probably thinks that he can't be removed from office if we're in a war. All about self-preservation, his only focus always. Well, if that were the case, then why do you guys think, you folks think, that he backed off on this
thing? Yeah, I don't buy that at all. Yeah. I mean, no offense to the listener. But,
well, maybe offense.
But the whole wag the dog thing doesn't make sense to me. Impeachment is not really a threat to him. There's no real reason for him to move it off the front page. It's if anything, his approval numbers have been going up a little bit during the impeachment hearing. So it doesn't make sense that he would need to change to wipe that headline off the front page.
Well, I thought you were going to say something else. I think he's scared to death of impeachment. I do. And, there have been indications from a reportage and other people that he goes a little crazy in the White House when they start to talk about it. So I think he is concerned, and he's also doesn't know what's going to happen. It may be that Schumer wins his way. It may be that the American people say, what's wrong with hearing from the witnesses? Why can't we hear from them? And he knows if we hear from the witnesses, he's in trouble.
I don't know that the witnesses will tell us anything we don't already know, but I just don't think this is much of a threat to him. Nobody thinks he's actually going to be removed from office. It doesn't seem to be hurting him in the polls. And why now? I mean, by the time impeachment starts, this whole the way the news cycle moves along, this whole thing will almost be forgotten.
Should you ever wake up in the middle of the night and worry about things that turn out not to be worrisome the next day?
All the time, and I was about to say, I think he obsesses on it. To be honest with you, I think it does stick in his craw, and I will admit to a certain level of perverse pleasure in watching Bolton step forward yesterday and offer, or the last couple of days, and offer to offer his testimony, and he's kind of sticking it back to Trump, and I think some of the people around Trump on this.
He has to do that, though, right? Bolton does.
Bolton doesn't have to do anything.
He has a book coming out, and if a book reveals all these secrets that he didn't offer to reveal during the hearings, that would look pretty badly for him.
Isn't that already true? Isn't that already the case?
No, because he's saying I would like to testify. So now when the book comes out, and he can say, well, that's all the stuff I would have told you if only you'd allowed me to testify.
Also, it could be a double, triple, quadruple fake out. In other words, he could be saying,
write that down.
I'll come and I'll testify, knowing full well that McConnell and the others aren't going to let him testify.
But they can't stop him from just. I mean, if the votes will be there to let him testify, I think, if he really wants to testify.
I don't know. These Republicans are.
Romney said yesterday that there should definitely be witnesses. That was what I saw.
He also said that he thought that McConnell.
They need like three more. They need three more.
Susan Collins will vote for. I mean, all these people who are up for re-election are going to vote for it because it's going to look bad if they deny this testimony.
I don't know. I think you're giving too much credit to the sheep in sheep's clothing, particularly with Collins. I think that she will get in line as quick
She'll
as
chicken
anybody.
Out, like she always
absolutely.
Does.
Absolutely. I think she's
McConnell owns
I think she's sold her soul.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul says President Obama delivered 563 drone strikes. President Trump hits a known terrorist. Dems heads explode. The proxies have been attacking the U.S. for years. Panel is so biased.
Well, that's all true. I mean, I think that's all true, that there is some hypocrisy, that, you know, when Trump does something, everybody pulls their hair out. But I mean, Obama got a pass on a lot of the same sort of stuff.
Obama didn't use the drones. He was wrong in the drones. He was attacked for it by liberals. And he never went after someone who is a part of a state government. This is like taking out Petraeus.
He also killed a lot of innocent people with those drone strikes.
Yes, he
did.
And
isn't that worse than taking out?
It is worse. I'm totally against drones. I think we should not be using them at all. I think there's huge unanswered ethical problems with the drones. But it's not true to say that our heads only exploded when Trump did it.
Well, I think there was not enough attention to a lot of the things that were going on in the Middle East during the Obama administration, including you talk about proxy wars. The situation in Yemen is certainly one that Obama got us involved in that has turned out to be disastrous. I mean, I think our Middle Eastern foreign policy has been really bad for a really long time.
And it's not
to act like it just suddenly started getting better. Maybe it got worse with Trump's election. I don't doubt that. But it's been bad for a long, long time.
That is true. And partly it is because there's no good, clear answer for America. Anything we did in Syria, as one example, was bad. There was no good outcome that you could
say. That's right.
Yeah,
which is why some people just say, well, don't be involved there at all.
And yes, they do say that. No one in Russia says that. That's the problem. Is that if we walk away, as we appear to be doing increasingly under Trump, voluntarily or not, Russia will move in. It's not as if the Middle East is going to handle this.
And then if Russia moves in, that's bad for us. Why?
Trade-wise, oil-wise, logistical place, location. The Middle East is a very important area of the world for many reasons, economic and defense.
I think if you look back at history, though, Russia has had its own headaches in the Middle East. I mean, look at the war in Afghanistan that they had to slink out of. I mean, it's a very, very difficult place for any country to be. And I understand people who say, well, we just shouldn't be there at all. This is.
But, you know, Chris, one of the things that our policy was is that we tried to extend our borders so that border protection didn't occur at the border, but you tried to push it out as far as you can. And that was the philosophy, is that you want to fight ISIS in the Middle East not in New York. And I don't necessarily agree with all of the drone policies. It actually gets into a more fundamental question about how we wage war. And again, yes, it gets back to the question of who gives approval to this. I mean, there's a lot of questions that I think are linked with this. My issue with the attack was, you know, the Revolutionary Guard is the military, is the elite military unit for Iran. Okay, we may have designated a terrorist organization, but you know, Iran just designated every military personnel in the United States as a terrorist. Mm-hmm. So blurring the line between a terrorist, which was typically not a state actor, and state actors, I think is a fundamental change from what Obama did versus what Trump has done.
I think you could turn around what you just said and say that ISIS is interested in attacking New York because we're so involved in the Middle East. Right. I mean, that in their minds, they're getting revenge for all the things that we've done there. And if we were less involved there, we wouldn't be on their radar quite as much.
You could, or you could say that this is, you could say this goes back 2,000 years of fighting in the Middle East. I don't know. All I can tell you is that, you know, the ISIS situation, again, the policy was that military intervention was tried to weaken ISIS where they were germinating rather than give them the ability to attack. And that was
in the JV.
I'm sorry?
The JV.
Junior varsity.
Yeah, isn't that what we were calling ISIS back in the day when we got out of Iraq?
Compared to Al Qaeda, correct. And then all of a sudden they became certain, way more virulent.
And but, here we go back to the.
Chris, don't you think also that there's a big difference? The way the Obama administration, regardless of how you feel about the drone strikes that they did during his time, they did have a relationship with our allies.
Yeah,
maybe the allies didn't always support what he did, but there was always a sense that there was a strategy in place, that we had support from our allies, that we were talking to our allies. Here, more and more and more, we just see a Trump administration that's using their power in ways that often we perceive, I think rightly so, being unconstitutional, without having any relationship with the allies, having no support from
the allies,
more becoming isolated on an island where everyone just wants nothing to do with us.
I will certainly agree that the Obama administration had much more of a strategy and behaved more responsibly in the Middle East. However, I just think it's not accurate to say that our policies there have been wonderful for decades and that suddenly we're, you know, everything's falling apart. I mean, a lot of what's happening now is because the policies.
I don't remember anybody saying that. Come on, be fair.
I don't know. My boss, Ray Graff, said you have to read some letters.
Oh, hey. Shartok, read some letters.
Thank you. George says, good morning. The U.S., my president, is playing the simple game of it's okay when I do it, it's not okay when you do it. And Jones says, talking about Soleimani. Good morning. Yesterday, Alan several times used the phrase, is not a good guy, referring to General Soleimani. Why say that? I think it's a bad idea. It reminds me of the buildup to the 2003 invasion of Iraq when Saddam Hussein was increasingly portrayed as pure evil and a threat to U.S. security, justifying Iraq and murdering Hussein. Secondly, if this is the rationale for assassinating a leader, then why isn't Trump laying out Kim, Duterte, Erdogan, etc., or does he think they are good guys? Don't you think that rational people need to disrupt this good guy, bad guy thinking?
Well, I think it's just plain fact, though. He was a bad guy.
He was a bad guy.
And all the other people she named are bad guys, too. I mean, you just state what the truth is.
Well, she makes a good point, though. But
Chris,
makes a good point.
I understand that we have the bad guys we like and the bad guys we don't like.
Right.
But that goes back to what I was saying about our terrible Middle East policy for decades and decades.
But let me put a fine point on the Middle East policy, okay? Nobody has had a good Middle East policy for 4,000-6,000 years. I mean, it's been a mess, and it's been tribal, and it's been warring. I mean, so nobody has it.
Which is an argument for not being so involved there.
If it wasn't so damn important, I don't think you'd want to be involved there. Another issue that I'd like to put on the table for future discussion is this whole issue of civilian control over the military as well.
Is that our homework for next Wednesday?
But it's something I think we should talk about because, you know, I'm a huge proponent of more civilian control over the military and not less. And I really feel like we're moving the
I'm a big proponent, as we've talked about earlier, for more congressional control over the military.
I am too, absolutely.
And along comes Trump, and he gives a threat to your basic premise, which is that it's good that the civilians control the military when it's the military, which will probably save us from a great deal that Trump is doing.
Well, they did make him back down from attacking the cultural sites.
Which, you know, yeah, which was an obvious violation of international accords.
I don't know that it was him that – I don't know if it was the military that made him back down. I mean, a lot of those cultural sites are Jewish and Christian cultural sites, and I think
– So his supporters said
– I think there was some backlash within those communities to –
Interesting. Would be. His comment was so begrudging. It was like, well, if that's the law, I'd like to obey the law.
Well, let's not forget, too, that Trump does get to pick the military leaders that you know, he wants to work with. I mean, these are leaders that he's
picked. And
then
he fires them.
Right? So it's conceivable that at some day we could have military leaders that are doing exactly what he wants. So I'm not so quick to embrace the military's decisions here. I worry that these are handpicked leaders by Donald Trump.
Well, anyway. I like the policy, but it's this particular civilian who is the problem.
Anyway, getting back to the letters, as ordered by my boss, Ray Graff.
Shartok, read the letters.
William says, a face-saving measure, imminent threat. Hello, panel, there's no question that if Iran wanted to, they could have inflicted U.S. casualties. They chose not to. This strike was simply a face-saving measure. President Trump drew a red line stating that if Iran killed U.S. soldiers, there would be grave consequences. Apparently, Iran has heeded that warning. The long history of this mass murder wreaking havoc in the Middle East and killing our soldiers makes the imminent threat argument irrelevant. William.
What? I'm sorry. I'm having a lot of trouble
following the
logic of that. And frankly, I disagree with it. I think if there was an imminent threat and we knew that he was there to carry out an attack that would harm, you know, American citizens or soldiers or diplomats, it's very different than somebody showing up and saying things that we may not like. And again, I would ask the listener to consider this. If you're going to follow that logic, then do you consider the lieutenant general who's in charge of our special forces to be a terrorist and therefore a viable target because of interventions that we may have in other parts of the world?
Ken says, Trump, endgame. What does Trump want, in capital letters, to get reelected? He didn't expect to win in the first place. Other than lining his and his cronies' pockets, is it to avoid being indicted for various crimes, or is it merely to feed his massive ego? And then we also heard from Henry, who said, Trump, Iran. Trump's problem with Iran is Obama. He has never given up his need to destroy anything that Obama has achieved, one of which is a negotiation to have Iran halt their nuclear weapons program. And okay. Julie says...
There is a weird fixation with Obama, admit, and with Hillary, though. But I would need a psychiatrist to sort of talk about that.
And Julie says, please stop using the collective we when applying responsibility to the environment for which we find ourselves. In this era of attention to pronouns in order to recognize dignity, I am requesting the panelists assign proper responsibility to where we are and that the GOP, who have worked with Trump and the Russians in 2016, is systematically attack our republic. Thank you, Julie.
Now, the president acts for the people of the United States, whether he believes that or not, and it is we. That is the appropriate pronoun.
Good or bad, you own it as well as the GOP. We own it as well as the GOP.
Well, I think the letter writer's point is accurate. I mean, I think, you know, you can say we, and properly, as you have just said, Rosemary, because we're all citizens in the country. But on the other hand, I think that when Trump, who is basically a climate denier, appoints people like coal magnates to important positions and other things, he deserves the massive part of the responsibility.
Well, responsibility is one thing, but you have to admit, it's just like saying he's your president and not mine. Unfortunately, not true. He's my president, too.
I don't know. I hear an awful lot of people saying he's not my president.
No, I've heard
you
say
that.
I
know. It's wrong.
That's wrong.
Who, me?
Yes.
No, I get it at home, however.
Shartok, read the letters.
David says.
It's a reminder that elections matter, though.
Yes.
Let him read the letters.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
Read the letters.
He'll fire.
Ray, stop interrupting Alan.
He'll fire me, and then you'll all be sorry.
Right.
David says, hearings on Iran. Adam Schiff has called for a House investigation into the decision-making that went into the strike on Iran. We need that, but we still need to know what went behind the decision to call President Erdogan of Turkey and withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. Conspiracy theories about Wag the Dog are going around, but it seems to me Trump is using the U.S. military to assert his personal dominance over Iran and the doves on the left in this case, and the Senate GOP that dared to criticize him on Ukraine aid when the story first broke. That's from David in Poughkeepsie. And we heard from Matt, who says, "Death to America." Panel, I read recently that the phrase "death to America" is an idiomatic phrase in Farsi that doesn't have the vitriol that we understand it to have. One person online talked about how a taxi driver would say "death to traffic" as a normal turn of phrase. Do any of the panelists know if this is in fact the case? If "death to America" really means "down with America," should the media be reporting it?
They're pointing to me, but I was in Arab country. They speak Arabic. This Iran is not Arabic.
Farsi.
It's Farsi, and they are not Arabs, so I don't know.
And then from Peter,
disappointed in your own.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna do some research.
Yeah.
Now.
Homework for next one.
And then from Peter on the subject of Iran, Rosemary. You speak with such reverence about the government of Iran, with such disdain about the government of the U.S. Pop quiz. Over the last 40 years, how many Iranians have fled their country and the government to live under the Constitutional Republic of the United States? Question two, in the same time frame, how many Americans have fled their country and government to live under the Islamic theocracy of Iran? Bonus. Yes or no question for Alan. You just made the remark about the sudden lack of dissent in Iran as a result of the assassination. Have you seen the photos of the construction cranes dangling the corpses of those who dared to dissent in Iran? Excuse me, bonus, you just made the remark about the sudden lack of dissent in Iran. Oh, I see. As a result of the assassination. Yeah, well, I did.
Do you want me to respond? I would just say how sad that America is being compared to Iran. It's, of course, we should be way above any kind of similarity or comparison with Iran. I do think we have a better form of government. I do not think our officials currently are acting as if that's true. We are acting like a third world country.
I'm with you. Maureen says, agency leadership during crisis question. Dear panel, I saw a frightening tweet listing all the federal agencies without confirmed leadership, like Homeland Security, et cetera, during the crisis. Please explain the possible consequences for our responses. Well, first of all, again, it downplays the role of the U.S. Congress because people don't have to be confirmed to be put into office. And secondly, it makes Trump even more powerful because he doesn't have to worry. He just puts another non-confirmed person into office.
Yeah, Alan, if I could put a finer point on that as well, that part of the confirmation process is a dialogue between the members of the Senate and to a lesser degree the House, but definitely the Senate, with potential nominees that establishes parameters for operations, things that our elected representatives are looking for from them. By not having that, there's no governor, and by not having confirmed people in place, and nobody's responsible. Well, that's just an acting position, we're just acting right now. We can't be held accountable for it. The lack of accountability and the fact that the only accountability then is back to the White House keeps everybody in line. It's a mechanism of control.
Sure, not that he the president fears just firing anybody confirmed or not, because he does. Andre says, war between Iran and Iraq, there were over 1 million casualties as a result of the war between the two countries back in the 1980s. Sobering statistic that continues to grow to this day. Generational suicide. Peter says, U.S. casualties. Hi, panel. According to Washington Post, the Iranians are claiming 80 U.S. casualties in the missile attack. If confirmed, what does that do to Trump and it's all as well tweet? How will they or can they spin it? Thanks. Well, Peter from Herkimer, where they have diamonds. What are you looking for?
I'm confused. Where did that number of 80 come
from? It came from the Iranian press.
Yeah, it is in the Post. I just read it.
Well, and it is in their interest to say they killed people.
However,
of course.
Yeah. This gets to Terry's point from very early in this program. Nobody really knows what's going on. Now, President Trump is scheduled, or at least loosely scheduled to be on about 11 a.m. to address the nation about the attack last night and any response to it. And we will, of course, carry that for you live. It was supposed to be 9. Now it's 11. We'll keep you posted.
But, you know, also, you know, this president has a history of telling us what countries we can believe and what countries we can't believe. So we never really know. Which country can we listen to today? I mean, recently we were told that everything that Ukraine says, we're supposed to believe. And then next day we say that what Russia says, we're supposed to believe or not believe. So who knows what to believe?
Linda says, imminent threat. Everyone seems to forget that the military leaders presented Trump with the option of taking out Soleimani as one of several options for retaliating on the attack on the embassy. They had foolish expectation that he wouldn't use that option because it was too extreme. There was no imminent threat. That's from Linda. But Linda, we don't know. We haven't got the slightest idea what the military said to the president or what the president said to the military. We don't know that. Okay, and Sonia says, patriotism versus nationalism. Quote from Sidney J. Harris, the difference between patriotism and nationalism is that the patriot is proud of his country and what it does, and the nationalist is proud of his country no matter what it does. The first attitude creates a feeling of responsibility, but the second a feeling of blind arrogance that leads to war. Nailed it. Sonia from Lenox.
That's good.
John says, killer drones. Here's a thought. Given this country's expansive interpretation of the Second Amendment, how long before a lethal drone becomes available to ordinary Americans?
Oh, I want one.
Think it won't happen? Weapons of war are already in civilian hands. Well, I have to say, I have a relative who has a drone.
A killer drone?
No. Oh. Just a drone.
No hellfire is attached to it.
Yeah, that's
a drone. It goes over your neighbor. You can't see his dog.
So notwithstanding Chris's hating dogs.
I love dogs, but
no, it's too late. It's too late. And feel free to write in to Chris Churchill.
Well, we have to take a break in a moment, so wrap it up.
But you know, Alan, if all you have to do is go on YouTube,
yep.
And then you can start to see how crazy the technology is changing.
And then those drones over the western part of the country, they don't know where they're coming from. Right. And we have to take a break. It's the roundtable panel at WAMC.org. And Chris Churchill is here, and we'll get back to his dog thing later on in the program. Terry Gibson, Robert Griffin, Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, and you, we will be back on the roundtable in a Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Wednesday morning. 10:33 is the time. Ray Graff with you. It's the panel. Robert Griffin, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. And I think, Alan.
Yes, Chief.
We have seen a stack of letters that might be record-breaking on this program today.
This is record-breaking, I think, today.
So, Shartok, read the letters.
Okay. Emily says, calling Iran a terrorist country. I think it's problematic to call Iran a terrorist nation, as someone on the panel just did. Careful about vilifying Iran. That's what this administration is doing. And how would you guys pronounce, because I'm sure I've killed her name, A-M-I-L-L-I-E, Emily? What do you think?
No. It's Emil.
Pass.
Emil would be with an
E. You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you write us back with the phonetics?
Yeah. Okay. And John says Trump's strategy. His strategy is straightforward, defined. Rather than appease, he chose to starve the regime of its ability to fund proxy terrorist activities while treating proxy activities as direct activities from Iran. This strategy, contrary to the panel's desires to paint the president as feckless, has been effective. Can the panel explain just where Obama's plane load of cash went? He called their bluff this week, and all Iran did was a not-so-impressive fireworks show. Furthermore, this wasn't an assassination, as Obama put the guy on the terrorist list. Speak the truth. And that's from John.
So I'm still struggling with, I know the plane landed in Tehran. I don't know where it went after that. I thought it was Trump that actually put
We looked that up during one of the breaks, and you came up with something.
Who put the Iranian guard on the terrorist list. In fact, I thought it was Obama who wouldn't do it because he felt and the political and military leadership felt that it was an escalation that would be unacceptable.
This is putting the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
Correct.
As terrorist organization.
That Soleimani headed.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Matt says Soleimani equals Trump's bin Laden. From Matt in Albany, I imagine that part of Trump's motivation is okaying the assassination of Soleimani was because Trump, quote, got bin Laden. Obama, quote, got bin Laden. And Trump needed a similar notch on his belt for both his ego and his reelection bid. Matt in Albany.
No, he claimed that with al-Baghdadi when he got him. And he was a terrorist, clear and simple. Soleimani was a state actor. It's not the same.
And that's where I think that what we're struggling with and you're hearing us struggle with is the equivalency between a state actor, a military recognized military state actor and a terrorist. And what we've done is that we have further blurred that really difficult question.
Correct.
Gregory writes us from Rhinebeck critically. Alan says Trump just needs an enemy. Like most commentators, he ignores the elephant in the room, Israel. Trump has openly and repeatedly proclaimed he's the greatest friend the Zionist state has ever had. His hostility towards Iran is grounded in favoritism toward and protection of that apartheid state. Gregory from Rhinebeck.
Well, I agree with that to some degree, but more importantly, I think this is a man that just wakes up every morning needing to pick a fight with somebody. I mean, the way he gets joy out of life is to beat people up, kill them, make them miserable. That's what he does.
It's worth mentioning, though, that Iran does want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth.
Without question.
And they make no bones about it. So, you know, keep that in mind when people are praising the Iran regime as some sort of enlightened, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah. I think you're right.
But that probably does play into Trump's mindset when it comes to Iran.
But this makes it even worse, though, Chris, is that we've given legitimacy to an illegitimate administration in Iran. Is that we have now placed them in a position where they are viewed, I think, by many across the globe as sympathetic vis-a-vis the United States, which is now considered to be the bully and enemy. We've flipped the whole dialogue that we've worked really hard to try to put them in a sort of behind that wall, and that's one of that. I think that's going to be a problem that we're going to continue to deal with for multiple generations.
We heard from Anthony, who says lies. Will the media and biased politicians ever stop the fabrication regarding the Iraq invasion that was based on all lies? Recall, if you will, Hillary addressed the Senate, declaring that Bush had the same information as Bill Clinton did. Her defense of his action and support for it really happened. And don't forget John Kerry declaring that anyone who believed that Hussein did not have nuclear weapons does not deserve to be president. Unfortunate and misguided as the war's operation played out, it is unjustified to continue the myth of Bush lies. Anthony.
I don't know if it was lies, but it was, you know, faulty intelligence for sure.
Well,
I think it was lies based on intelligence that didn't deliver the facts they wanted, so they made up facts.
So you think the president knew, is what you're saying?
I think
you think that Bush knew?
I think Cheney knew at least and pushed.
I don't think anyone really knows that for sure, though. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and Amy says, question for the roundtable. Dear panel, I haven't heard much discussion of the simultaneous plane crash in Tehran that was headed to Ukraine, and Iran was bombing U.S. military sites in Iraq. It appears awfully coincidental and opportunistic from my view. Do we know who was on that plane? And by the way, that's Amy in New Paltz.
Well, we don't know the specifics, but we know that Iranian, Canadian, Ukrainian, Swedish, Afghan, British, and German nationals were among those killed, among the 176 people who were killed.
Which you have said before. So when Amy says she hasn't heard much discussion, we did discuss it, and we discussed it at some length earlier in the program.
But she had to go to the bathroom. She just missed it.
Yeah, a lot of people do this. I've been in this business a while. A lot of people do it because they didn't hear it at the moment they turned it on the radio.
But that's okay.
There's a lag with these letters, though, too, right? Some of them were probably written. There's
you
so
betcha.
Many. Some of them were probably written an hour and a half.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
But I will note, I mean, there is a strange coincidence here that I think needs to be investigated. But we were talking earlier about the plane crash down at the city that occurred not long after 9/11, it freaked us all out because we thought that this was somehow a terrorist or some attack. So before we go jump into conclusions, it was waiting to see more information about what happened.
Well, everybody on all sides seems to be denying that this was a terrorist-like event. the Iranians, the Americans, everybody else.
Well, the map I saw on TV, and we have CNN on with no sound here in case the president decides to
come on.
It looked like it was 2 minutes from the time the plane took off until the time it was lost from the radar. So it's possible maybe the Iranians thought it was a U.S. attack and shot her down. And maybe that's why they're not giving up the black box at the moment.
You make a point, as always, boss. Mike says, let's remember that U.S. embassies are safe places for Americans to seek refuge when in trouble abroad. Mike from Boston Kill. Remember when I said, what happens when you lose your, you know, when you lose your passport?
I have used the embassies. They are difficult to get into. They charge for services that are free here. They are not friendly places. If they're our best representation to a country, then we do not come off well.
How do you feel about TSA?
I was just going to say the same thing, Ray.
Oh, God.
Yeah, okay, let's go to witnesses. Good morning. I agree with Alan.
Oh boy, that's a rarity. Must be an eclipse.
I agree with Alan. If Trump is not afraid of witnesses, why go to such lengths to prohibit testimony? If witnesses will exonerate, you want them to testify. And that's from Doug.
Sure that wasn't from Joe at home?
Oh, I talked to Joe yesterday.
I did too.
He is feeling great.
He said that to me too.
He's going to try to be back. Mark your calendars, Joe fans. January 30th is
the tentative date for a return.
He's due to interview, I'm not going to say her name right, Jhumpa Lahira, the novelist, at the Writers Institute on the 30th.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And he seems like he's really in a good mood and he's feeling.
He does. Sounds great.
The knee rehab is going very well. He'll be back.
Well, I want to know is why don't you people ever tell us what's happening with Joe?
Well, yeah. We forgot today.
Okay, so
let's take a break here before the next letter, okay?
No.
All right. The email address is panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Major chords. It's nice to have some relaxing music here on the round table. 10:44 is the time. And my gosh, it's, we're 16 minutes away from President Trump. So we're keeping you posted and keeping you apprised of current events. Until then, it's the round table panel. Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, Robert Griffin, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok. Shartok, read the letters.
I will, sir. Thank you for giving me that opportunity.
You're welcome.
Janos says, Libya. Dear panel, which administration was instrumental in the removal of Gaddafi? Look at Libya now. It is overrun with ISIS and other terrorist groups. It was one of the wealthiest countries in North Africa. Where'd all the gold go? Hillary rejoiced at the sanctioned killing of the head of state. Is that okay? And that's from Janos in Great Barrington.
It wasn't okay, but it was not a country in great stability and wealth at the time that happened. Gaddafi was a horrible leader, and it was an action taken. They were in the middle of a civil war, and the action was taken, as again I said, there are no good options when the United States acts in the Middle East, and it did not work out.
Mm-hmm.
She has said since she wouldn't do it again, but at the time it was the best decision made at the time.
But it also raises a really interesting question that we've got to think hard about is that when you talk about replacing a regime,
correct,
what happens when you've created a bigger problem? And Libya is a great example, and you've got to start to take that into consideration,
correct,
when you think about our foreign policy.
So Iraq too, for that matter. Saddam Hussein, horrible man, yeah. But look what happened to Iraq after the United States decided to make a change.
Couple minutes left here, Chief. So,
okay. Dear panel, I feel the only ones who are still with Trump are those who refuse to be informed about reality. That's about half the country, by the way. Or those who lack any capacity for keeping track of what is going on and how dangerous and insane Trump is. I give more credit to the American people instead of wanting to believe that they are mindless puppets. And that's from Linda.
Well, you know, one thing to point out is that technology, especially on Facebook, is making it easier and easier and easier to create false reality. I mean, the big thing now is this technology that can create false videos. And the ability to actually have people saying things that they never said, doing things they never did, in a very, very realistic way.
And we saw Obama yesterday, just yesterday, somebody put up a picture of Obama with his arm around
the congressman.
So this whole thing about reality, you know, is a real issue.
A congressman did it. Yeah.
Well, the latest thing is Australia, which is the climate deniers don't want to admit that this is probably a sign of bad things to come. So this whole narrative has arisen that it's arson that's causing it. And it's true that some arson has occurred because there are crazies in every country, but that's not the main source of these fires. And that spread everywhere. It was in The Australian, which is a newspaper, an outlet that you would think was well-sourced and reliable. It was an English newspaper, The Guardian, who outed it as a disinformation campaign.
Gus checks in from San Francisco.
All right. Have some rice-a-roni.
Hi. Is there still a rice-a-roni?
Oh, it's the San Francisco treat.
There still is?
You have 12 seconds, sir.
Right, sir. Impeachment.
The San Francisco treat.
A friendly reminder, the impeachment has been accomplished. Trump has been impeached. It is a trial and conviction that is now in question. Please mind your tongues.
Yeah.
Just in San Francisco. Well,
mind your tongues. All right. How brief is this one? You have 10 seconds.
Right. Neil says, Obama versus Trump. Hey, Chris, here's the difference between Obama and Trump's drone strikes. Obama were the result of official U.S. policy to attack terrorists wherever possible. Trump's was done on a personal whim to satisfy his need to be seen as strong and decisive. This guy has no policy aside from self-aggrandizement.
We are done. Thanks to the roundtable panel. Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Chartok, and Bob Griffin. Let's see. We're done now for this particular part of the show. The Congressional Corner is coming up. President Trump due to speak to the nation, and we will have that for you live, presumably at 11.